Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, longtime radio host Diane Rehm explores a deep question. Should people with terminal illnesses be allowed to determine exactly when their lives end? Rehm stepped away from journalism a few years ago, in part so she could openly advocate for the right to medical aid in dying, an option not legally available to Rehm's mother or her late husband when they face their final illnesses and wish to take control. We'll talk with her about what she learned by interviewing people on both sides of this divisive issue, including doctors, religious leaders, and patients diagnosed with fatal illnesses. Our conversation starts after a short break. Control may be the closest we can get to a miracle when we are forced to bear the unbearable. While few of us will ever feel truly ready to accept a terminal diagnosis, some people derive great comfort from the idea that they might be able to have some agency over how and when they draw their final breath. Some people call that assisted suicide. Others use the term medical aid in dying. And the choice of words often boils down to how you feel about the right to die on your own terms. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Diane Rehm has been thinking about this for a very long time. She witnessed the end of her mother's life when she was just 19. Later, she cared for her first husband as he grew weaker and more disabled from Parkinson's disease. She's come to a conclusion about what she will want at the end of her life, but Rehm is also deeply respectful of people who see things differently. She hosted the Diane Rehm Show on public radio from 1979 until 2016. These days, she is host of WAMU's podcast, On My Mind. Her new book is called When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. She joins us from the studios of WAMU in Washington to talk about it. Diane, welcome back to Think.
Chris, thanks for having me.
So you lost your mother when you were 19. She was only 49. And at the time, doctors were not able to keep her comfortable at the end. What kinds of conversations did you have with her about dying?
You know, she really did not talk about dying, nor did my father. I had learned from our family physician when I was 16 that she was mortally ill and that she would not live for another 18 months. Well, she lived a bit longer than that. But at the end, Chris, because her body was filled with such incredible fluid and had to be drained every few days, she truly was suffering and begging to die. Mm. From the time I was a little girl, I can remember saying to her, "Mama, I want to die before you do. I don't ever want to live without you." Well, as it turned out, she did die, and she died suffering. And I think most people would prefer to die not suffering, as I would.
Your first husband, John Rehm, died a few years ago suffering from Parkinson's disease. What options were legally available to him at the end of his life?
He was in a nursing home, Chris, in Maryland. And at the time, Maryland did not have an aid in dying law, and they still don't. I testified before the Maryland State Legislature last year in support of medical aid in dying. We lost by one single vote. Mm. It has come up again this year, and we are far more optimistic that there will be a majority of delegates who see that medical aid in dying is not, as you referred to it, suicide, but truly is a realization that the end of life is near and one would like to have some comfort and control over the way one dies. My mother and father never talked about the fact that she was dying. Never a single word. In fact, when our family doctor told me, and I went out to the car where my dad was waiting for me, I said, "Daddy, I mean, the doctor says Mama's gonna die." And he said, "Don't say a word to your mother. Don't say a word." And never a word was uttered. But I think in part because of that experience, the fact that my father died just 11 months later after my mother, of a broken heart, I think death has been part of my life for a very long time.
Of course you didn't want to lose your first husband, but I'm sure, Diane, it was incredibly hard to tell him you couldn't help him with his wish to die.
Well, and he did know from the moment he walked into that nursing home that I could not and would not be able to help him die should he ask for it. In fact, the doctor in charge said to me, "Diane, please, you are a public person. You cannot do anything to help your husband end his life." In the end, he had to take matters into his own hands, stop eating, stop drinking water, stop taking medication. It took him a full 10 days to die. When he said, "This is what I'm going to do," I said, "Sweetheart, are you sure?" And he said, "I really am sure, and I'm ready for the next journey."
Do you think, do doctors tell you that choice to stop eating and drinking caused him more suffering than if a preparation had been available to him that could have stopped his heart within a matter of minutes or hours?
No. As a matter of fact, the doctor told him that if he wished to die, this was the only way he could do it, and the doctor promised to keep him comfortable so that other than the grimaces I saw on his face as he lay in a very, very deep sleep after the third or fourth day, I did not see him suffering. But those grimaces told me that somewhere deep inside there was suffering going on. I held his hand for much of the time he was dying. I stayed there on the last night, trying to sleep on two chairs with my little dog Maxie on my stomach. But, of course, sleeping on two chairs is not a way to sleep. And so I got up in the middle of the night, still holding his hand. I started then writing my last book on my own, just being so infuriated that John could not have had medical aid in dying, knowing at the time that there were only three states in the country that had it. Since we've begun work on the documentary, which will be shown on public television next spring, and from which this book is taken, there are now nine states, plus the District of Columbia, which do allow medical aid in dying. And there are so many safeguards and so many restrictions that there has not been one protest, complaint in the 22 years since Oregon became the first state to allow medical aid in dying.
What kinds of rules surround medical aid of in dying in those nine states in the District of Columbia?
There must be two physicians who agree that a patient is within 6 months of dying. That patient then must be able to say personally, with no one else around except for a doctor, that he or she wishes to have medical aid in dying. In other words, no pressure from any relative or friend or someone else. It must be a statement on the part of the individual who is within 6 months of dying. In some states, Chris, there's even a psychiatric interview to ensure that the person is of sound mind. And in addition to that, an individual must be able to self-ingest the medication. And people who have ALS have been the most frequent users of medical aid in dying, and they are able to self-ingest, not through taking the medication by mouth, but by virtue of being able to press down a lever which will help that person ingest the medication through the rectum.
One of the things that you discovered was that for patients who self-administer this medication and take it by mouth, it tastes horrible. It seems like that's something that medical science could easily get around. Did you come to learn the reason why, this final act of mercy is denied these patients, or at least that's what it sounds like to me?
Well, it sounds that way to me, too, as though there could be and should be a more pleasant ending to life. On the other hand, a young woman named Lori Pushanidis, who lives in California, when I said to her, and on my part, I think looking back, it was a stupid question, a stupid thing to say for me to her. I said, "Are you worried about how awful this stuff tastes?" And she said, "Diane, after all the treatments, after all of the chemotherapy, after all of the radiation I've been through trying to stay alive," she said, "that's the least of my worries."
Hmm. She ultimately requested medical aid in dying. Her life ended without having used it. Was it the idea that she could use it if she wanted to that gave her comfort?
Absolutely, and comfort is just the right word. She said as soon as she learned that the state of California was considering passing medical aid in dying, she told her doctor she wanted that doctor to make a note that she, Lori, wanted to be on that list. She wanted a record of having asked for it immediately so that people would know her intentions. And exactly as you say, when she was told she was within 6 months of dying, she did make that request, did receive the medication, and said it gave her great comfort.
My guest is Diane Rehm. We're talking about her new book, When My Time Comes. We'll be right back. listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Diane Rehm, who hosted The Diane Rehm Show for 37 years, now hosts WAMU's podcast On My Mind. Her newest book is called When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. Diane, you have a clear sense of your own views on this, but I think one thing that readers will really appreciate that I appreciated was that ever the journalist, you also spoke to a lot of people who oppose medical aid in dying. One person you talked to was a palliative care physician who says modern medicine can keep people comfortable through their final hours and days, both physically and also spiritually or existentially. Can you talk a little bit about that conversation?
Well, that conversation was absolutely lovely, and I appreciated her comments. I must say I heard from other physicians who said precisely the opposite, that there is some pain toward the end of life that medication cannot touch. However, from that first doctor's point of view, she felt that every day of life is precious and therefore should not be interfered with, but should be supported. And I totally understand that point of view. In fact, you know, if you're a person who is deeply religious and believes that God should be the only one to decide when life should end, I think that is a position to be respected, acknowledged, respected, and supported. If you're, on the other hand, a person who says, I want every single option that medical science can provide, I'm in support of that for you, if that's what you want. But what I want for me should not be dictated by what you want for you. Therefore, for me, choice is what is at the heart of this. And the choice should not be made by state legislators or physicians who do not wish to participate in medical aid in dying. I had a doctor of my own, a fairly young woman, and after she had been my doctor for about 4 or 5 years, and after my husband died, I asked her whether she believed in medical aid in dying and would help me should it become the law in D.C., which ultimately it did. Would she help me with medical aid in dying? And her answer was no, because she said, I don't want to have to go through the training. I don't feel comfortable about having my name listed as a physician who will provide medical aid in dying. So, Chris, I had a choice. I could stay with her and do as my husband did, starve myself to death at the end, or I could find another doctor who did believe, as I do, that a decision about the end of life should be my own. So I found another doctor.
Do you know if doctors from who were trained in places that are not quite as influenced by the canons of Western culture, the Hippocratic Oath, are as reluctant to provide this service as doctors who are trained that the first and most important thing every physician must do is do no harm?
Well, it depends on how you define harm. Hmm. Harm, indeed, could be offering yet another treatment, offering more chemotherapy, more radiation treatment, more medication of one sort or another, because many, if not most doctors, older doctors most especially, have been trained that they are there to heal patients and not to give up. Well, if I, as a patient, cannot talk freely to my doctor about what it is I want, not so much about what they want for me, but what I want for me, then I've got to find another way to proceed. I've attended lectures given for young medical students who are so much more open to the idea that helping a patient through the end of life with medical aid in dying makes so much sense. So I think what you're seeing is a generational shift, not only in the population at large as we grow older, but also in the way that medical students are being taught about how to interact with patients, how to learn to listen more carefully to what that patient wants, as opposed to telling that patient what he or she should have. I think there was a time in our history, certainly as I was growing up, where the word of the doctor was the word, the law. Mm-hmm. And now that's so much less the case. We are all privy to information about whatever our ailments might be, privy enough, smart enough, willing enough to ask the kinds of questions that should be asked. I always, when John Rehm was so ill, went to every single doctor's appointment with him, because sometimes patients don't hear what they don't want to hear. And an extra set of ears and eyes is a wonderful thing to have. So in the end, John's death certificate read not that he had taken his own life by starving himself to death. He died because he had Parkinson's disease. And he said, I no longer wish to live in this indignity, knowing that this disease is going to take me even further into indignity. So I think doctors are learning more and more about how to listen and how to hear what it is their patients are feeling and wanting, rather than simply telling them what to do.
Do we need to have distinctly different rules governing medical aid in dying for patients who are depressed in addition to suffering from a fatal physical illness?
Well, tell me, Chris, if you were suffering from a serious fatal illness, wouldn't you be depressed?
No, see, this is the thing. I totally get that. But I also wonder, we talk about We talk about, you know, obviously we don't want people who are deeply depressed but physically healthy to take
exactly.
their own lives if we can get
exactly.
help for them. So where do we draw, why is physical discomfort a justification for doing this and mental anguish, most people agree, as a society, is not?
It's not just physical anguish. It is the realization that within 6 months, this person will die.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The reality is this person will die. Some people suffer from mental anguish all of their lives. And that is so sad. You know, there are organizations in other parts of the world who recognize that mental anguish, emotional depression, the desire not to live anymore, even when one is physically healthy. There are organizations around the world who acknowledge that. Dignitas, for example, in Switzerland, has taken the lives of patients with injections. In the Netherlands, the same is true. But here in this country, mental health is not considered on a par with physical health because of that 6 month determination that the end of life is near. Now, you can argue that some people who have perhaps been given that 6 month determination live on for 20, 25 years. I mean, we've heard those stories. They don't happen very often, but they do happen. No doctor is perfect in estimating just how long that patient is going to live. But two doctors making the same determination are likely to have the understanding of exactly where this patient is toward the end of his or her life.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. We have Maggie on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. And out of nowhere, your last remark, didn't you interview Art Buchwald at some point when he was in hospice? That was classic.
But I did. I did. He was wonderful. And he was in hospice for so long that the hospice facility told him to go home. And he lived for another year with his family at home. Art was such a great guy and had such a wonderful sense of humor. And there, right in that hospice facility, he received the French Legion of Honor Award from the French ambassador because, as you probably recall, he had lived and written a great deal in France and about France. He was a great guy, and you never know, he did live on for another year.
Having spoken to a number of people who have faced this decision in their own lives and also people who care about them, do you find that dying people who are preparing to make this choice themselves are less afraid of the idea of medical aid in dying than their loved ones who don't want to lose them?
That's such a good point, Chris, and one that is part of the reason I've written this book and worked for the last 3 years on this documentary. It is so often the relatives who are not in sync with the patient. What it takes is conversation. And I'm not talking about just one conversation. I'm talking about many conversations. You know, in this country, talking about death is kind of the last taboo. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there are now death cafes around the country, all over the country, where people who are strangers or people who are neighbors and friends come together and talk about death, what they want at the end of life, how they are preparing themselves for death. Let's face it, this population is getting older. And with that aging process comes the realization that preparation is needed. We all need to have these conversations with our children, our parents, our friends, our relatives. The more we have these conversations, the more accepting we become of the idea that death is not to fear, but to be accepted as simply part of the life cycle. We are born, we live, and we die. Nobody gets out of here alive.
Yeah, we should note something that you heard from numerous people who support medical aid in dying was that they don't exactly want to die. They want control over the circumstances surrounding the end of their lives.
Back to Laurie in California, she said, if I had my druthers, I'd live to be 90. But I know I won't, and I don't want my children to see me suffer at the end of life, as she said, I saw my mother, my aunts, my uncle, all suffer at the end of theirs.
My guest is Diane Rehm. We're talking about her newest book, When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Diane Rehm, who, of course, hosted The Diane Rehm Show from 1979 through 2016. She's got a podcast now for WAMU called On My Mind and a new book out called When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. Diane, have there been cases in which dying patients might have felt obligated to speed their own deaths, not so much based on what they wanted, but because they felt the burden to their families? You mentioned Lori talking about not wanting her children to see her suffer. They felt their families were burdened financially or otherwise by their care.
You know what, Chris? I don't think anybody really wants to die. I think that during all of these interviews with people across the country, I never heard that from anyone with whom I spoke. And one of the dying people with whom I spoke was my high school sweetheart. We had been in communication ever since we left high school. He had been married for more than 60 years. He worked at a nuclear facility. He got prostate cancer, which spread to his bones. And in the end, we spoke via Skype from his home in Boulder, Colorado. His sense of humor was intact. His lovely wife was standing right there with him. He was on oxygen, but continued to be just as sweet and understanding and ready to face the future, concerned only for his wife. Concerned because they had no children, but knew that because they had such wonderful friends and relatives, that she would be in good hands. She talked about their wonderful life together. I mean, there was no sense of any kind of pressure coming from anywhere. And in the almost 25 years that Oregon has had this law in place, there's not been a single case brought forward accusing anyone of putting pressure on a dying person or a person saying, you know, I want to lead this life because I don't want my family to have any further financial obligation. No, instead, it was relishing each day, each moment with friends and family. You know, the first person to seek medical aid in dying here in Washington, D.C., was Mary Klein. And at the time, there was no D.C. aid in dying law in place. So she and her partner began lobbying on the Hill for medical aid in dying. She testified before the city council. Her partner at her side constantly. And finally, when D.C. passed its law, then she had a terrible time finding a doctor who was willing to help her. And finally, that doctor did come along, and she is in the documentary. Right now, there are very few physicians in the Washington area willing to help. There are a great many in California, a great many in Oregon. In other parts of the country, it can be hard to find a doctor. But I can assure you, from the people with whom I spoke, from their survivors, from their friends, from their doctors, from their families, there was no pressure. There was no feeling of, I've got to die because I'm costing my family money or being a burden.
We have an email here from Brad in Austin, Texas, who asks, if I live in a state like Texas that does not have aid in dying privileges but want to move to a place that has them, what must I do to plan? For example, must I establish residence in a place like Oregon, or would I be eligible for these protections immediately? And I assume Brad means immediately upon arriving in a state that does have these laws.
And the story you should look up is that of Brittany Menard, mm-hmm. who lived in California. Shortly after she was married, she found she had an inoperable brain tumor that was going to end her life. She and her husband pulled up stakes, moved to Oregon, where indeed she did have to establish residency, and that takes 30 days. Then find a doctor willing to take her case on, as she did. You may have read about her in many, many publications. She kind of became the heroine of California's right to die law, because it was after she was forced to leave California, knowing that the convulsions she was having, the terrible, horrible headaches she was having, that her life was going to end in suffering. And so, while she and her husband and her mother stayed in Oregon, and she did stay there longer than the 30 days required, her husband was forced to go back and forth to his job in California just to keep them going. But he was totally supportive of her decision, totally supportive of what, in the end, she decided to do, which was to receive the medication and on the day of her choosing with her husband, her mother, her friends all around her, took the medication and ended her life peacefully. She had awakened that very morning, not sure whether she was going to carry through with it that day or not, and then had a terrible convulsion, and that made up her mind for her. But to answer specifically your caller's question, he must indeed establish residency in one of the 9 states. And there are some on the East Coast, Maine and Vermont, for example. The issue is before state legislatures in both New York State and Massachusetts as we speak, and, as I said, is coming up again in the state of Maryland.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. At the end of the book, Diane, you share a conversation you had with your grandson, Benjamin, who at the time was a sophomore at Dartmouth. What did you say to him, and why did you choose him to have that conversation?
Well, I am lucky enough to have a grandson who likes to visit me. And so he happened to be there while we were filming in my apartment. Now, before I even approached Ben about this, I asked his mother, my daughter, because you never do anything so important without asking a parent. And my daughter was totally accepting and said, if Ben is willing to do that, I have no objection. So he took out his iPhone, began recording me while the video person was recording him, as I told him that should I develop Alzheimer's or dementia, I wanted to be told that in the early stages thereof, because I personally have no intention of living out a life with Alzheimer's. I've seen too many cases. I know how suffering it can be for those around the person with Alzheimer's, and I know the suffering that an individual who loses all contact with those around him or her, does not recognize family, can experience perhaps no joy in life. And that is not to say that of all patients with Alzheimer's. Some can be very joyous in those last years. I do not want to experience that. I told Ben that because I wanted his mother and father to know. I wanted him to know. I want my son and his wife to know. I want my husband to know, so that everyone is very clear that I will make my own decision when that time comes.
Is that your greatest fear, Alzheimer's?
Well, I think an even worse one would be a serious stroke, which would leave me incapable of making that decision and speaking with doctors about that decision. You perhaps know stroke patients who've lost a good deal but can still stay alive. I don't want to be in that position. I think for me, when I can no longer serve society, when I can no longer have joy in life or dignity in life, I don't want to live any longer.
Can you give us advice, Diane, if we are the recipient of a conversation like this from a loved one who says, these are the terms in which I would want to, you know, be allowed to end my own life if I so chose? It can be very hard for those of us not in that situation to hear. How can we actually listen to someone who's trying to explain this to us?
I think you just have to listen with your heart and not just make a decision out of what you would want, but open your heart and hear what that loved one is saying to you. It's not one discussion, Chris. It's many discussions, and they have to start sooner rather than later. How many people are left being forced to make that decision for a loved one in a hospital, seeing that loved one hooked up to all kinds of machines? I wouldn't want that for myself, nor would I want it for a loved one.
Diane Rehm hosted The Diane Rehm Show for 37 years. She is host now of WAMU's podcast, On My Mind, and author of a new book called When My Time Comes, conversations about whether those who are dying should have the right to determine when life should end. Diane, it's always such a pleasure. Thanks for spending this hour with us.
Chris, thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.